Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, friends. Welcome back to another episode of the New Evangelicals podcast. So if you notice, I'm not in my normal spot. I'm actually in my kitchen area, living room, dining room. I don't know. My wife's laughing at me as I record this, so I'm just going to roll with it and not edit anything so you can see what kind of idiot I am behind the scenes. But can I help you? I'm trying to record an intro for New Evangelicals. All right, let me try it again. Hi, friends. Just kidding. So listen, on this episode of the podcast, I never told you guys why I'm down here. It's really hot outside and my third story loft where I do most of my recordings is too hot for my computer. So I moved everything downstairs for this interview. And let me tell you what an interview it was. I interviewed Mike Graham. Mike wrote a great article called The Six-Way Fracturing of Evangelicalism. And Mike did a really good job here of kind of giving six different types of Christians and kind of where they land and how they intersect. And it's very helpful and it gave me so much clarity. So I brought Mike on to talk about this article. And honestly, Mike really knows his stuff. He's super intelligent. I will tell you now, he might be a little conservative for some of you, but that is okay. Because like Mike said, he's all about good faith discussions, meaning even if we don't see eye to eye, we still want to be able to hear each other and share perspectives and do our best to learn. And this is a great interview where you can do that. So I hope you enjoyed this episode. That being said, of course, I want to say thank you to everyone who has shared the podcast and shared the YouTube link. If you could do us a huge favor, as I always ask, please give us a rating and a review and a like and a subscribe. It really helps us out. And it's something that's so simple to do. It takes about 2 seconds. That's my wife. You want to say hi to everyone? I'm not going to edit any of this. It's going on Instagram, on YouTube. Want to say hi?
Hey, all you cool cats and kittens.
I'm definitely going to edit this episode. Anyway, this is a really weird intro, but I'm just going to roll with it. So yeah, if you guys can like and subscribe and share the podcast, that'd be super helpful. And of course, thank you to everyone who has given to the New Evangelicals to make all of this happen. If you want to donate, the link is below. Okay, I'm going to stop this intro before it gets any weirder. Without further ado, here is my interview with Mike Graham. That was weird. Mike, thank you so much for making time for the interview. Yes, hello out there. It's fun recording video now because people sometimes they don't match up the voice with the body. You know what I mean? I do a terrible job of that. So now there's video to this, which is great. Thanks for making time. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Tim.
Absolutely. So, you know, what we're talking about today is an article that you published called The Six-Way Fracturing of Evangelicalism. I came across this maybe 3 weeks ago now, give or take, read it, thought, wow, this is really great. Give it to my audience. They loved it. So I really want to dig into this article today. But before we do that, why don't you kind of give us maybe just a big picture overview of who you are, your background, and maybe the inspiration behind this article?
Yeah. Thank you, Tim. My name is Mike Graham. I'm the executive pastor at a church called Orlando Grace Church. I'm the executive producer for a podcast called As in Heaven. It's a podcast that lives on the Gospel Coalition podcast network. That podcast is focused on taking one really large topic and doing a deep dive on an entire season on a particular topic. So in our first season, we just did a deep dive in Orlando. I'm in the city of Orlando. So we did 8 episodes just kind of trying to reintroduce our city to the churches that are in our city. And then Our second season, and this is when we joined the Gospel Coalition podcast network. Okay. And we produced content that wasn't just, you know, regional specific, was we did a deep dive on basically racial justice. And so, so we just finished 24 episodes with that. And then we have a bonus episode on where we interviewed Tim Keller and then Erwin Entz, who's the moderator for the PCA. So we we interviewed those guys live at the this past April at the TGC national conference. So those are the two main hats that I wear. I'm very interested. So our third season in our podcast is going to be on de-churching. So we're currently experiencing probably the third largest religious shift in American history. Probably somewhere on order of 75 to 110 million people have left the church in my lifetime. Yeah. So it's probably the second or third biggest shift behind the first and second Great Awakenings, but it's moving the opposite direction. Yep. So have a lot of interest in that and are working with some sociologists currently to study that quantitatively. And we're going to be doing, after we finish our nationwide quantitative study on that, then we'll be, we have season three written in terms of the arc of that on de-churching. Sure. But we'll probably do 20, 25 episodes on that particular phenomenon, and which I think would probably really resonate with a lot of your audience.
So, I would say so.
Yeah, but we don't want to speak about anything without doing it intelligently and without hard data. And so it's really important to us to work with information that's hard and fast, and where people are telling us in their own terms what they are thinking, feeling, and experiencing. Mm. So, so that's kind of my background. So this story here, writing about the six-way fracturing of evangelicalism. My core thesis is that evangelicalism is fracturing into six roughly distinct groups. Mm. And I think that 2016 was kind of a nationwide X-ray. And
yes, it was.
If 2016 was a nationwide X-ray, then COVID year, and I'm going to use the term COVID year as everywhere from like February, March of 2020 up through, at least the middle of 2021. And so COVID year, I think, was a 3D MRI.
Mm,
and so as a result of I think there's a lot of things that, kind of everybody's cards are on the table. You choose your metaphor of, there's no more water line for the iceberg. We see everything. Everyone's kind of thoughts are more or less kind of out there. And I think there's a lot of relational, organizational, institutional, theological, cultural, political, socioeconomic, and even ethnic implications for those things being previously unseen, but now really kind of seen. And I think it's going to take a couple years for really all of that to flesh itself out and what that means. But if you think about relationships, and I'm not saying this to be crass or to demean relationships in a way or to quantify them, inappropriately. But if you think about relationships a little bit like stock tickers, and instead of monetary value, what's being measured is how much intimacy is wise between you and that other party. Mm. I think a lot of relationships have been really repriced, both in 2016, there's a little bit of volatility, and some relationships probably got repriced around then. And then I think relationships really got pretty dramatically repriced during COVID year. And obviously, the animating things, the kind of nationwide Rorschach tests, so to speak, a global pandemic and how you process that brings in science, brings in lots of different things, in terms of, how you process those things. Obviously, at least, Breonna Taylor, Ahmaud Arbery, and George Floyd certainly re-bringing up to the fore the national conversation on racial justice. Yeah. And bring all different kinds of thoughts policy-wise into that, whether that's policing or reparations or just general relationships, relational proximity, these kinds of things. Yeah. And then obviously another very contentious election cycle and kind of included in that, on maybe on the bookend of that being the events of January 6th. And so these things, you know, really kind of illuminated, you know, key differences in terms of how people process the same events, and or the filters through which have been really revealed to in terms of how people think about things. You know, you can look at the same inkblot and you can come to very different conclusions. And you have to ask yourself of like, okay, you know, how do we look at a lot of these same things and come to such divergent, you know, conclusions? Those are things that are, you know, kind of really worth exploring. And so, you know, as we, you know, just kind of going through all of this, these thoughts were really kind of forming in my head around kind of fall of last year. I've really just kind of starting to feel some of these different groups pretty acutely, and some of their differences and, you know, divergence. And then, you know, as the year just kind of continued on, you know, whether that's the racial justice conversation or the political conversations or just how even people process the pandemic, it's like, wow, you know, three pretty big wedges at the same time that seem to really kind of end up slotting people into some pretty increasingly identifiable tribes. Yeah. And then you start to realize like, okay, these wedges are driving people into various tribes, but the tribes really kind of already existed if you kind of trace them back. And so if I could, I'll share those six tribes. Is this a good time for that?
I just want to comment briefly on everything you just said, because you really, you know, with real good language and really articulately, you know, really summed up a lot of how a lot of us on my account have been feeling. You know, like, we have everything you said, we're like, yep. You know, I call them ingredients. Like, what are the main ingredients that create this like deconstruction cake, essentially? And you kind of just walked us through all of the big ones, you know, like all the ones that people like myself who grew up evangelical until recently, until I was asked to step down, was at an evangelical church, you know, have said like, yeah, I don't know if I can, you know, I'm not sure what to do with this whole election year with how COVID's being handled. So I appreciate you at least giving language to it. You know, like, I appreciate you even saying that, yeah, like, you know, as a pastor, we're seeing these trends and we want to know the data. Like, we want to know, because people like myself who are not, you know, sociologists, I can't give you hard and fast data. I can just give you experiences. I can give you thousands of DMs I get, you know, et cetera. But I can't give you like, okay, here's the statistical number. So it will be interesting to see if my experience and the people on my account, if that experience is really reflected in whatever study you end up, you know, in the conclusions that you come to, or if we're just kind of in a bubble that really isn't the norm. I suspect, of course, it's the former, but that's only because of my bias, right? But, you know, based on what you said, I'm looking forward to that study. So that's very cool stuff. I'm looking forward to that. But yeah, that being said, if you want to hop into, you know, these six categories that you created and how they intersect, I think that would be wonderful.
Yeah. Okay. So, if you want, I'm sure in the show notes or whatever, you can, you know, maybe under this, you'll probably, I'm sure, put the, you know, the article link, and definitely, if you want to hit pause here, you can go read it. It's like a 10 minute read, 3,000 words, but, if not, here we go for the kind of six categories. The first category is a neo-fundamentalist evangelical. So these are people who have whose biggest animating concerns are political and theological liberalism. Sometimes this group might overlap and or have similar concerns as Christian nationalists. So there might be, you know, kind of the Venn diagram, there might be a significant amount of kind of overlap there, but those things aren't necessarily the same thing. Some key figures in this world would be like John MacArthur, James White, Tom Buck, Tom Askell, founder of Apology Radio. To a lesser extent, you know, kind of Ligonier Ministries is kind of in there. Mm. You know, Jeff Durbin and those guys. You know, and each one of these, you know, there's different flavors to kind of, you know, you get some of these guys are Reconstructionists and, you know, others. And then there's like even another world that's not, you know, it's more outside the Reformed world that would be like Robert Jeffress. And it would be more like baby boomer centric, that really brings a lot of like the that's more on the Christian nationalism side of things and less on the intellectual side of things. So that would kind of be what we're going to call ones. So a one neo-fundamentalist evangelical. Okay.
Got it.
Twos are mainstream evangelicals. So historically evangelical, if you remember, or maybe you interacted with this guy named Bevington, the technical definition of an evangelical is basically according to this thing called the Bevington Quadrilateral. Mm-hmm. And the four qualities of this were conversionism, which is basically the idea that, you know, you have to be born again. Activism, which twos aren't necessarily huge on unless it's pro-life / anti-abortion kind of stuff. So activism is a little bit selective for twos. Third being biblicism. Usually biblicism is just here another way to say a belief in having a high view of scripture probably means inerrancy, probably means a belief in infallibility of scripture. And then fourth, crucicentrism, which is, that's just a fancy way to say a centrality for the atonement, and particularly probably in view penal substitutionary atonement. Mm-hmm. With that. So that would be like kind of theologically where like twos would be. And this would probably be true also for threes and fours. We'll get to that in a second. Really a lot of the differences between twos, threes and fours come down to activism and what does that mean? And the kind of, there's a lot of agreement in terms of what it means to love the Lord your God with all your heart, soul, mind, and strength in the vertical relationship, where a lot of the rubber meets the road. And the divergences between threes and fours is the, what does it mean to love your neighbor as yourself? How does that play itself out? What is the role of the church in the world? And kind of philosophy of ministry stuff, and or one's affect and how strongly you feel about those things. But anyways, still talking about twos. Twos are primarily still concerned, like ones, with the encroachment of the secular left and the way that that might be imported or be a cause for concern with respect to the local church. Their concerns are more about theological liberalism than political liberalism, but political liberalism is still a major point. Politically speaking, twos would be still very much monolithic politically. They would be very much at least 80-85% plus in voting for the GOP. So those are just some of the from an ethnic standpoint, and maybe this is a good time to just kind of mention this. This whole taxonomy that I've created here, I could have put the sixfold fracturing of white evangelicalism. These categories would not map as cleanly in other forms of Protestantism. So whether that's mainline Protestantism or Black Protestants, some people who are Black and Protestant also identify as evangelical. Many do not. Okay. Right. So those that do not, or mainline, these categories will not map quite as well. I think some of them will still resonate. But just note that that's a thing. Even in some of the feedback, got some feedback from some Catholic and Orthodox folks that they're seeing some of these things too, but there's going to be different flavors and contours to all that. So just know, like, if you're coming from, if you're listening to this and interacting with it, and you're coming from those traditions, know that this is my vantage point, and it's not, these categories might not be as clean and neat for you. And you can just kind of take and rework those things, kind of for yourselves. The extent to which there'll be overlap between these categories in my part of Protestantism versus your part of Christianity will be related to how the similarities will only be because of theology. It will be because of the common animating factors that are cultural, political, socioeconomic, and ethnic. So largely ones and twos are probably going to be mainly white. Okay. Really, you start to get greater ethnicity starting around 2.5 and above. You usually don't get much below that. unless it's a pretty niche voice. And again, evangelicals, they love their niche voices, and you can always find somebody who will, you know,
yes.
who'll
pair. I'm thinking of someone right now that you mentioned earlier. Yeah.
You can always find somebody who'll say what you want to say, and
and
we'll reward them with likes and shares and whatever. But I'm not here to talk about that. That's another,
topic for another
time. And the ethics of that too.
Yes.
But everybody deserves their own voice in the same, you know, standpoint. My only, Absolutely. You know, I want to take every single person seriously. I think the only thing that bothers me about that whole dynamic is I want to listen to people who are good faith conversation partners.
Hmm.
If somebody's a good faith conversation partner, let's talk, you know, but if somebody is say on the grift, or they're doing something because they're just trying to be provocative to build an audience, especially if they're trying to do that to monetize that audience, that's another conversation. And so, you know, how you're going to take that and process that's a little different. Okay. On the threes. Threes are neo-evangelicals. Okay.
Okay.
Now bear in mind, pretty much all of these are my own terms. Okay. Both neo-evangelical and post-evangelical have previously been technical terms that have meant different things sociologically than what I'm saying here. Okay. I just couldn't come up with other terms beyond some of these. Post-evangelical, which is fours. This is a term that was used in the past during the emergent church movement.
Yeah.
But I'm kind of reclaiming that term here because that hasn't been much of a conversation for the last decade. And so I'm repurposing that. So same a little bit with neo-evangelicals. So a neo-evangelical is somebody who sees themselves as an evangelical in the global sense of the term, in that global movement, but, and doctrinally, they're very much Orthodox. They would see very eye to eye on theology with twos. There's going to be philosophy of ministry differences between twos and threes. But threes, neo-evangelicals, threes, are not going to use the term evangelical necessarily super frequently. They might use that term when they're talking with other people who are like twos or threes, when we're having an insider conversation within, you know, Protestantism. But if you're talking to your neighbor, you know, and say they're not a Christian or they don't have good categories for these things, like, I'm not going to say that, you know, hey, I'm an evangelical pastor, you know,
right.
I'm going to say, you know, I'm a Christian minister, you know, or I'm a member of the clergy, or I'm Protestant, or some of these, you know, different kind of things. I'm in the low threes. That's where, you know, I'm at personally. So everybody who's listening to this, you deserve to know, you know, kind of where my vantage point is here on this. And so my understanding of some of these things in terms of nuances is going to be best really a little bit like somewhere in the 2.5 to like 3.7 ranges where I'm probably going to be, have the best insights, just because of, you know, that's kind of my world. So threes, new evangelicals, within the church, they are both concerned about the secular left and the secular right, politically and theologically. Most threes are going to find themselves probably politically homeless, and probably in a place where it's like, you know, I'm sure there's some threes that probably, you know, held their nose and voted Donald Trump. There's probably others who held their nose and voted, you know, for Joe Biden. And then there's probably many who voted third party. And there's probably a number that just like, nah, I'm sitting this out, you know? Right. So, threes are very much concerned, about, the cleaning of the inside of the cup of evangelicalism, to borrow Jesus's, you know, his conversation with the Pharisees of cleaning the inside of the cup. So some of the things that threes are concerned about cleaning the inside of the cup would be racism, misogyny, and sexual abuse. This is kind of probably the biggest trinity of concerns. As a three, I think that these are real concerns. I think they warrant significant conversation and real action. I think that involves three things. I think that involves repentance, reform, and renewal. Now, the difference here between, and this is kind of where we get the differences between threes and fours. Fours, so these are people that we're going to call post-evangelicals. These are people that have, they might have fully left evangelicalism in terms of the technical term. Okay. They would never use that term, you know, for themselves. So, you know, say take somebody like Eric Mason or Jamar Tisby, you know, who are Black Protestants, right?
Right.
You know, so like doctrinally, zero difference between, you know, me and Jamar or me and Eric, you know, I mean, with Jamar, he's Presbyterian. So we, you know, have minor disagreements about, you know, baptism.
Right.
I'm just, I'm like 60-40 Credo versus Pato, right?
But, right.
And whatever, I mean, I'll die and Jesus tell me I'm wrong and that's okay. I don't care. Whatever. So, but, all that to say, you know, so you could have people where it's like doctrinally, there's very little different. Some fours may have left evangelicalism for a different kind of Protestantism. They may have left for the Anglican Church or the Episcopal Church or, you know, LCMS, ELCA, you know, other kind of mainline expressions, the Seven Sisters, so you get the Methodists and anyways, all, you know, Disciples of Christ, Church of Christ. Then you have a lot of, you have a lot of kind of historically Black Protestants. So you have Kojic, you have the African Methodist Episcopal, the AME, church. A lot of these folks would probably live in the somewhere in the 3 to 4.5 range, depending on you know, contextual considerations. So so some people have kind of left evangelicalism for a different expression within Protestantism, and then some have left evangelicalism for, say, the Orthodox or the Catholic Church. And so that's where kind of fours live. And so doctrinally, there might be some pretty significant differences within this group of fours. However, my experience is that they still have really these three same animating concerns of concerns over racism, misogyny, and sexual abuse. Where threes and fours diverge on this is where is probably in affect. Fours have probably felt these things personally and more acutely. And they may have experienced more woundedness in terms of having really negative experiences, you know, firsthand. If we had more time, I could tell some ministry war stories. You know, I sense from, you know, just kind of our dialogue that, you know, you have your own war stories, you know, that are there. And so I think sometimes, you know, firsthand negative personal experiences with either Christians, Christian institutions, or just observing the unhealthy aspects of the movement of, you know, in the movement as a whole, can really move somebody from the 3 to 4 range and be like, you know what, this is so divergent from like the Jesus that I see like in the Bible and in the text. I just don't even hardly recognize some of these things. Can really move somebody, you know, in that direction.
Can I just comment briefly on that? Briefly. And you're, man, this is so good. All of it's so good. I don't want to interrupt too much. I think, you know, your assessment of that 3 to 4 shift, at least in my personal experience and in some people that I know on my account, is accurate. Because I would definitely, even when I started this account in December, this new evangelicals thing, you know, would find myself maybe on like the high 3 range, you know, like 3.5 to like, you know, 3.9. But since things have transpired the way that they did, I find myself more and more, you know, like actually that was really like concerning, and having more empathy for people who maybe who are sounding who have sounded the alarm louder than I have in the past, now saying, actually, I get it. And it's because of my love for Jesus and wanting to follow him better that I think there's a real concern here. So I track with that. You know, I think that it makes a lot of sense because I've experienced that in my own personal life.
So, yeah, I mean, and I have firsthand, like some of my closest friends have been, have experienced sexual abuse. And some of that has, you know, has been in the proximity of church. And it's like, man, especially if anybody is listening to this right now, and this is your story, I mean, I just want to like, just like hug you through the computer screen, pray for you, like, tell you that that is wrong and that's evil, and that Jesus like really does love you and he cares for you, and he really wants to minister to you, and don't give up on him because of just all the sinful and broken things that have happened to you. Yeah. The same thing is true if, you know, if you're listening to this and you've been, you know, you've experienced racism in the church or misogyny and these different kinds of things. If there's a, and maybe I'll get into this in a little bit, and just in terms of a word that I'd love to say, you know, for anybody who's listening, is kind of the difference between deconstruction and what the reformers called semper reformanda. And that's just a Latin term for that translates always reforming.
Yeah.
And I think this is maybe a little bit of the difference between threes and fours as well, and just kind of nuancing things a little bit. Once you get beyond like 4.5, you're entering like really hard deconstruction, right? Semper reformanda involves deconstruction. Okay. The idea of always reforming from the reformers was this, and this is my background, guys. I went to Reformed Theological Seminary in Orlando, and I'm cerebral and analytical. And so bear with me as I just kind of unpack this term. So the idea for the reformers was this, is that we're never going to fully arrive, you know, doctrinally, theologically, practically, emotively. And, you know, if I can import some, you know, Leslie Newbegin here as well, it's just, I think sometimes we don't necessarily comprehend how important it is for us to communicate in ways that are comprehensible to our context. And I think, you know, if you think about this in, here's a mirror image. So here's a photo negative for you. Satan is really good at contextualization. Okay. He understands in the Western world that I want to convince the Western world that God doesn't exist. And I don't, and Satan doesn't exist either. Okay. But then in other parts of the world, he very much wants to convince people that gods, God or gods, you know, Allah exists or gods exist or whatever, and that he exists. And, you know, and so I think we have to communicate in ways that are comprehensible to people. And this is why, like, we have to always, you know, the Christian faith, there's certain aspects of it that are fixed, and there are other aspects of it that are dynamic. And so the parts that are dynamic are, you know, just kind of our religious expression, you know, our beliefs remain the same, but the way in which we belong, you know, it evolves, and, you know, many of our ethical norms in terms of behavior are fixed, but other aspects, you know, will be different depending on your context. You know, for example, like the meat sacrifice to idols, it's going to look different. You know, you have all kinds of meat sacrifice to idols, you know, kinds of scenarios that play themselves all around the, you know, different world, and where ethically, you know, you wouldn't want to do certain things in this part of the world, whereas, you know, this part of the world, yeah, fine. You know, anyways, so the idea of, you know, that we're always reforming is we're always finding, you know, better and deeper ways to understand God's word. We're finding better and deeper practices to be connected to God, you know, whether that's, you know, through prayer or various different disciplines, you know, ways that we might recite, you know, different things. I mean, we're complex creatures, you know, physical, emotional, we have chemical systems, biological systems, you know, all the neurobiological stuff. I mean, we're super complicated. Anyways, all that to say this, threes are more concerned with the idea of semper reformanda than they are deconstruction. And I want to, if you're a four or somewhere in the, you know, 3.6 to 4.5 range, I want to talk to you for a second, because my concern about deconstruction, and deconstruction is necessary. You have two different things. You have diagnosis and prescription. Diagnosis is where you identify what's wrong. Prescription is where you figure out, in light of what's wrong, how do we fix it? I think both threes and fours have really strong agreement on diagnosis in terms of the prescription of what to do about that in light of that, I think that's where the divergence is. And I think this is where threes are more on the Sefer Reformanda end of the spectrum, and fours are more on deconstruction. My concern with deconstruction is this, is at some point, we can't always be known for what we're against and we're not about, you know? And I think all threes and fours would say, you know, we don't want to be about racism, misogyny, sexual abuse, these different kinds of things. But then we do have to land somewhere, right? And we do have to state positively, okay, if we're not for these things, what does it look like to address and redress those things through repentance, reform, and renewal versus just kind of saying, you know what, this is, guys, I just can't even, you know, this is so messed up, so broken or whatever. Like, you know, we can really run the risk of just saying, you know what, I just don't need this. I'm out. You know, whether that means I'm out belonging, behavior, or belief, you know, in rejecting one of those three, two of those three, or all three. Because I think, you know, deconstruction can move into deconversion. And when you start to move into deconversion, you're talking about, you know, you can, you know, you can deconstruct and de-church in those three categories. You can deconstruct belief-wise of like, well, I no longer believe in this, this, and that. You can deconstruct in terms of belonging of like, okay, I'm out of the institutional church. Like, I'm not going to do that anymore. You know, I'm going to have an alternative way of expressing some of those things. Mm-hmm. And then you can deconstruct from a behavior standpoint of like, well, I used to follow these particular ethical norms, but I'm just not going to do that anymore. You know, you know, whether that's sexuality or, you know, various other, you know, ways that you can, you know, change, behavioral norms. So this is
where, can I give a thought to that?
Would you mind? Yeah. So those, I think for normally I wouldn't unpack like three, four differences as much as what I am here, but just kind of given your particular audience, I think it would be helpful for people to understand and also know that, like, again, it's a spectrum. And you're going to land probably somewhere in between a particular thing. And so these are not necessarily binaries.
Right. Yeah, no, I think that's really good. I think that, you know, I'm a big believer, like you said, of having good faith conversations, right? Like I tell my audience consistently, like we should be able to listen to perspectives that might, you know, challenge us without getting offended about that. And then we can make the judgment on how we want to proceed. You know, it's up to us or up to you. You know, one thought I wanted just to kind of just maybe like share, and again, this is not, I can't speak for everyone, you know, but at least the themes I see personally on my account are, you know, a lot of us were in the evangelical church and have either gotten, you know, frankly, just put it bluntly, kicked out or fired for various reasons, including saying things like Black Lives Matter on our Facebook accounts. I mean, I have real stories of that. And I think what's tough for a lot of us is that we desperately do want to see the church, specifically the evangelical church, loving their neighbor better. And we want to see a shift from focus on event to focus on community. But we feel that there is, you know, we really feel like a lot of places just don't want us, you know, and like they just see us as like these frankly liberal Marxists who just want to destroy the church because of that one and two kind of, you know, perception.
Yep.
And it's tough because I know at least for me, like, you know, I'm very committed. I'm not saying that you're not saying I'm not. I'm just, you know, I'm just giving you some perspective. You know, I'm committed to evangelicalism. I mean, for crying out loud, my account's called The New Evangelicals. You know, I'm reading the book right now, Discovering an Evangelical Heritage, you know, the Wesleyan tradition and how radical it was, you know, abolition right now, you know, pro-feminism, you know, pro-civil disobedience, you know, I'm just like, I like this. You know, there's some radical stuff here. And I think a lot of people who are just either hurt are to use a church word, a season of just like, okay, I need to rethink some stuff. And also we're finding other scholarly sources that have really helped us. Like for me, a big one I say at every podcast, Bible Project, Tim Mackey, you know, like what they are doing, how they've helped me reframe my relationship to the Bible, what it is and what it isn't, combined with guys like N.T. Wright, John Walton, et cetera, it's people who know their stuff who are conservative in their orthodoxy completely, you know, they're not preaching like a non-resurrected Christ, has really just made me rethink so much of the the dogmas that I've been taught my whole life, growing up in a homeschooled, you know, kind of fundamentalism, John MacArthur type, like, you know, fundamentalist reformed tradition. And it seems like whenever we push against that, or we tell the church, you know, hey, we should really repent and be better, the response is, you know, not here. And then when we vent it on social media, it's now we're divisive, you know?
Right.
So I think a lot of us feel like we don't know how to do this on their terms that get them to listen to us. So now we just say whatever we want, and it is what it is, you know?
I think it's important for us to name some of this, right? So I think one of the things that we've learned in this 5-year period between the national X-ray and the national 3D MRI is that a lot of the unity that maybe we experienced in churches kind of growing up had more to do with cultural, political, socioeconomic, and maybe even ethnic factors than you know. I'm sure there's definitely Jesus in the mix, right? But sometimes, like, when push comes to shove, and, you know, there's people that you've been in relationship for a long time, and you're like, hey, I still like you. Like, I'm a 3, you're a 1, you know, like, that's okay. Like, you know, we're good faith, like, conversation partners. We have all these relationships with one another. You know, yeah, sure. We see, you know, these things differently. And, you know, sure, I'd love, you know, if there wasn't so much of a gap, you know, kind of between us, but, like, I don't reject you, you know, but sometimes what you get in return from that is, well, yeah, that's cool that you feel that way, but I don't feel that way about you. Right. Mm-hmm. And I think that's where the relational tension kind of starts to really rise, especially, you know, if you're in that 3 to 4 range. You felt that, you know, because lots of people have probably abandoned you relationally, and or either otherized you, or wanted to put you out, or maybe even fired you, or given you, you know, maybe even penalized you for not being, you know, for not being the same spot. And I think this is where there's just a lot of animating, you know, concerns that just aren't, quite frankly, aren't Jesus, right? And so this is where, you know, it's important for us to just kind of, you know, name that and realize, okay, you know, and if you find yourself in that place of loneliness, you know, and certainly if you're still inside of an evangelical institution as a 3 or a 4, you know, you're going to feel that tension, especially, you know, with anybody 1.5 or below. Sometimes even 2 and below. And I think that's really, you know, 1s and 4s have already decided that they're not going to occupy the same physical spaces anymore. So 1s and 4s will not go to the same churches. Okay.
Yeah.
That sorting has largely already happened. And so I think where the biggest fault lines are 1s and 3s still kind of find themselves in the same spaces, and 2s and 4s kind of find themselves in the same spaces. And everyone's kind of feeling a little bit uncomfortable about that. And so I think those are where the next 2, 5, 10 years, I'm not sure, we'll kind of see, I think, a real sorting, a resorting, so to speak, of evangelicalism. And I think what will happen is, as I mentioned in the article, there's, you know, every church is a rubber band, okay? And every rubber band has a certain amount of elasticity before it breaks. And I think what's happened over the last 5 years is the elasticity of the rubber band before it breaks under a little bit less tension than what it did before. And so what that means, if at the parachurch level, the denominational level, and then at the local church level, is that in order for any of those respective level layers of institutions, there probably has to be, the tent has to probably get a little bit smaller in order for the same level of cohesiveness that was had before we've experienced this particular cultural moment. And so, you know, if your institution had, you know, 10 units out of 10 of cohesiveness before all of these things, and you were able to span a range of, you know, 1.5 to 3.5 before, well, you might not be able to span, you know, a range that's quite that large anymore and still have 10 out of 10 cohesiveness. You're going to experience more friction, you know, as evangelicalism kind of continues to splinter and fracture. And so my thesis, and I don't know if I'm right, is basically that 3 kinds of churches will come out of out of this whole phenomenon of the fracturing of evangelicalism. And so I've called these type A, type B, and type C churches. So okay. Type A churches are would be primarily ones and twos. Type B churches would be primarily twos and threes. And then type C churches would be primarily threes and fours. And so I think right now, you know, most churches are type A or type B. I think type C will be a bit of a growing area in the years to come as, you know, I think we're experiencing a generational shift, a transition in power, whether that's Fortune 500 companies, all the way down to denominations, parachurch entities, all the way down to individual local churches, where power is being handed between, you know, from baby boomers, usually passed over the Gen Xers, to the either the, you know, so you have the older millennials who are sometimes called, so and this would be anyone born from 1978 to 1984. So if you're in the 78 to 84 range, you're either the Oregon Trail generation, the Xennial, or sometimes called geriatric millennials. So I think what's happening within, you know, whether it's companies or, you know, or even churches, we have this generational shift in power. And what's unique about those born from 78 to 84 is they still grew up outside and offline. Mm-hmm. You know, they didn't get Wi-Fi and laptops until after undergrad. Yeah. Yet they're still familiar with all the tools of the people who are, you know, 5, 10, 15 years younger than them.
Yeah.
And we still look, you know, I was born in 82, so we still look kind of young, but, you know, we're starting to feel it.
I'm born in 88. Okay. And so I was like a teenager when the internet really, well, I was like 12 when the internet really hit, you know, so I can still remember a blurred background, but I remember just being outside a lot, you know, and now obviously it's
yeah. So, I mean, and so I think there's a lot that's going on, you know, transitionally. I know I didn't mention this before. Super quickly, here's what fives and sixes are. Fives are those who are who have actively fully left the church. They're de-churched. What we've learned about the de-churched and who are fives, a lot of times there's still a handful of Orthodox beliefs that are there. Usually not all of them. Usually the time you see all Orthodox beliefs in somebody who's a five is if they've been a sexual abuse victim, usually in the church environment. Mm. So you have people who are truly like followers of Jesus, some who are fives. It's probably not many, but that is a thing. So if that's you and you find yourself in that, you know, position, like I'm so sorry for your experiences. And then finally, sixes are those who are de-churched and deconverted. Right. So
they're just out.
So some fives would be like Dustin Kinsrue from, you know, lead singer from Thrice.
Oh yeah.
Michael Gunn.
His wife follows my account. I felt like famous. Like, whoa, I can't believe it. You know?
Yeah. If you're listening, Dustin, love your music. And,
same.
Matt Jensen, Andrew Lisi, say hi.
Can I comment on your church thesis briefly? Would you mind?
Yeah. Go ahead.
And I want to respect your time. I think you have a hard stop in just a few minutes here. Sure. I think is that correct? Okay. So I'll be brief, and I'll get maybe some of your final thoughts. I do think your thesis, you know, sounds correct, because the type C, you know, idea is something that I've been thinking about church for years. I mean, longer than any of this other stuff. And, you know, I always say, like, we have to move from a foundational core value of the event is what centers us to the community is what centers us. You know, it has to be a shift. And I find that people in that C, I think you said it's twos and fours, something like that.
Threes and fours, which would be primarily your audience.
Yeah, I mean, we're that's the thing, is we want community. We want to be gathered around the Eucharist. We do want to just study the Word. We want those things, but we just have such a hard time doing it in spaces that are designed to become spectator sport. You know, especially as a volunteer my whole life. Yep. You know, a few people volunteer full time, and everyone else just shows up, receives the sugar rush, and goes home. So I do think that type C will continue to grow if it hasn't already. You know, and that's more of almost like the Frank Viola kind of house church model a little bit, you know, like that kind of idea, but a little bit different still, I think, for some of us.
Yeah, and this is where, like, I think sometimes people's personalities play into some of these things too. You know, like some people can be, you know, more corporate or more punk rock, you know, like,
yeah.
And some of that will play itself out and might move, you know, somebody a little bit, you know, on that scale. You know, if you're more punk rock, you're going to be, you know, a little bit more, you know, like in One Direction versus, you know, if you can, if you can withstand, if you can look beyond and forgive some of the rigidity of institutions and appreciate that sometimes that rigidity can work in the favor in the long run because of more comprehensiveness of assets and centrality, and or what's possible at with higher degrees of structure and mobilization. Some of personality is going to play into that, you know, a little bit, you know. I mean, I'm wearing a, I have both of these.
My hands are tattooed.
I have these things, you know, I might listen to ABR and Polyphia, you know, when I'm
nice. Writing, hey, now we're talking. Yeah. All right. I'm seeing them in Philly soon. They're local boys.
But you wouldn't know it from just looking at me.
I love that. Yeah. But we got to talk offline about some music choices. Yeah. I'm a drummer and I'm all about that. So it's great stuff.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, I guess, you know, I think that looking forward in terms of my hopes for, you know, for evangelicalism, I think that it really boils down to repentance, reform, and renewal for me.
Yeah.
That's what I want to give my kind of life, ministerial life to. And I think a lot of that is going to be fleshed out in ethics and anthropology the church in the 21st century, I hope, in America is known for, diving into the doctrine of the Imago Dei and its implications, in the early middle 21st century. If that isn't what we're known for 50, 100 years, 200 years from now, as church history kind of looks back on us, I have pretty serious concerns. I cut my teeth ministry wise in my first job working with crew overseas in Italy. Mm. And you know, what we saw in Italy kind of felt like a bit of a time machine. What Italy had seen from the 1930s to present was a kind of a 90-year battle between the secular left and the secular right. And when I say secular left and secular right, I mean even more radical expressions of these things than what we've ever seen here. With the secular right, you know, the rise in the 30s and 40s of Mussolini and real fascism. And then in the 50s through the 70s, a real blowback to that, a real rise of serious communism and serious socialism, you know, that would make, you know, anything in, Northern Europe, you know, look pale by comparison. And so this battle between the secular left and the secular right in Italy has very much ravaged the entire country, and nobody's left unscathed from it all. And what it's the fruit that it's borne, you know, I saw it firsthand, you know, from 03 to 05 was cynicism, powerlessness, nothing works, disbelief in institutions, and in a word, resignation. And so that covers any category, economic resignation, religious resignation, relation, you know, I mean, it's just like, so really all you have, you know, left is, you know, kind of just communities and relationships that are more, highly localized. And that's where people form their identities is, you know, highly local ways. So secularism will continue to wash over the West. And I think this is where Charles Taylor is really helpful for, you know, to read. There's a number of different summaries of Charles Taylor. If you can't, you know, stomach, you know, reading Our Secular Age, you can read James K.A. Smith's summary, which is pretty good as well. But, you know, secularism is going to wash over the West, like, and that includes America. America is a little bit more stubbornly religious than some of our European counterparts, whether that's continental Europe or, you know, the UK. And so it won't wash over us in the same way that it that it has some of those other places, but it's not done with us. We're just starting this actual revolution. We haven't found the bottom. We're not at the bottom of the rope of the sexual revolution. There's a lot more chaos that's coming. For sure, in 5 or 10 years, people are going to start loosening up on things like pedophilia, and probably, the gulags are going to come after me in 20 years for criticizing pedophilia, here, now that I've said this word on this app that, where data's living forever,
Yeah, right, on YouTube.
I probably just indicted myself, forever on this. But these things are going to work their way out. And we should have our concerns on the left and the right. For me, in my context, and as a type B church that's primarily twos and threes, I'm more concerned about the secular right than I am the secular left. But the secular left is not, I shouldn't ignore my left flank either. It's just like I got 100,000, size army over here with pitchforks and tiki torches, and then I've got 30,000, army on my left flank with different types of weapons, right?
And so I think what's scary is that at least on the right, it's really embedded with like Christian nationalism. I mean, that's correct. I talk to pastors often. I always tell them, I said, listen, this will be a hard pill to swallow, but you might think you're discipling your congregation, but Tucker Carlson is discipling them. Sean Hannity is, Charlie Kirk is. That's who's discipling your congregation. Like, that's who they're hearing day in and day out. And that should be a problem.
Tim, we can't win. Here's the problem.
Tell me.
It's volume. It's the sheer volume of information, right?
You're right.
So one of the things I'm going to be working on just in doing some writing on in the future is this idea of an information diet. Okay. Everybody that you interact with has an information diet. Right. And part of that information diet, if somebody's churched, might be, they might sit under 30 minutes of preaching a week, maybe 45, depending on your tradition. You might sit under, a small group for an hour. You might, there might be an hour of education that happens, and you might grab coffee with somebody if you're like really involved or whatever.
Right.
And you might volunteer.
That's
for
like
an hour.
Deep cut.
like if somebody's got all 5 of those hours, I'm like, oh my gosh, wow. Okay. 5 hours, right?
Exactly. Right.
But then, what do you do when somebody is, interacting with cable news 2 hours a day? I don't care whether it's MSNBC or Fox News or whatever, and you're listening to this and that voice. We have all the challenges that are going on with the Netflix documentary, The Social Dilemma, kind of brings up.
Yes, totally.
In the way that algorithms have figured out that fear will keep our attention on your platform faster than love or any other emotion. And so they're going to show me things that keep me on their platform longer, because the longer I'm on their platform, the more I can be monetized. If a platform, if a social network is free, then you are the product. I'm the product on Facebook. I'm the product on Twitter. And so they're going to show me things that keep me on their platform longer, which includes things that might make me mad, which might make you wonder like, hey, why is Facebook showing me this post from these people? We're not really friends. Like, I don't spend much time, I don't see these people in real life. Well, they're showing you that because they figured out that you spend 37% more time when you see something that they post you that kind of makes you frustrated or whatever. And so they're going to, wow, cool. Well, when we show them, so-and-so's content, we can keep them 37%, longer on our thing and, monetize them, 14 cents, per time you've clicked on our app versus, 11 cents,
Right.
So, and then you have, I think Tim Keller tweeted about this the other day on how social media is not necessarily an echo chamber so much as it is a place where people are creating and forming identities and or signaling to those entities in terms of how one identifies. And so I think this is another piece to all of that as well, because people are looking for positive feedback loops and affirmation from your particular tribe. And so this plays itself out with the fracturing, one start to hang out online, twos, threes, fours. And the only time they interact, ones, the only times that ones and fours will interact anymore is online. And that's when they're throwing rocks at each other.
Totally.
But at the end of the day, it's fruitless because it just ends up mutually reinforcing kind of where everybody's at. And the only thing that I've learned, So my children are Black. We had a long infertility journey. And so we have currently two adoptive children. They're both Black. And from my experience in doing work in pursuing racial justice and helping people who are in different parts of that conversation actually make any sort of progress with one another, the only way to do that is through relational intimacy. Mm. I've found that even the best content, whether it's writing, speaking, or any other medium, there's no substitute for embodied interaction. Yeah. So I don't really have much hope for the unfracturing of any of these things, because I don't really see many cultural or sociological forces that are encouraging us to have embodied interaction. And I say that here as, you know, on a Zoom interview, you know.
Right.
So I think until there, I guess maybe is like a cultural or sociological revolt against digital mediums. And I'm not saying that in like a Luddite way, but until we really are face to face and embodied with one another, I just don't see any of these things really changing. And I don't know. I'm not trying to be cynical. I want to be, you know, tremendously hopeful, but I think for me, the hope is in that semper reformanda of, you know, we need to bring repentance, reform, and renewal to the church. And until we do that, things are probably going to continue to fracture and to continue to decline.
Yeah, I think that's well said. You know, for the record, like I'm all about always reforming. I've used that line before. And that's a lot of my motivation to even renegotiate, you know, my faith. Like, what does it really mean to be a Jesus follower in 2021? You know, like I, what keeps me up at night is thinking about what are the things that I'm not seeing now that I can look so clearly back, you know, in the past and go, oh, slavery, how could Christians support that? What are the things now that I am like not aware of that are happening now?
Right.
That in 50 years, Christians will say, how could Tim not see that right in front of him, that huge injustice, you know? Because, I mean, that is, like you said, there's such a dehumanization of people in every way, economically, you know, racially, all you know, product wise, right? Like with social media, you know, we're the product. And it's like, I think that what must be cling to and what must be so foundational to the Christian is that every human being reflects the image of God. And that's tricky for me when it comes to like my opponents politically, right? You know, the ones right now, I follow Jeff Durbin, I follow James White, and I see their Twitter and I just go, oh my God, like I'm losing my mind, you know? But I have to remember, like, you know, you can oppose someone and you can oppose someone's views and theology without dehumanizing them. Like, like it's possible to do both at the same time. You know, you can say, actually, I don't think that's healthy at all without belittling the imago Dei inside of them. And I think that's how you break that cycle, right? Because if not, like I always tell my account, we don't want to become fundamentalists of the other side.
Correct.
Like I'm not trying to be a fundamentalist again. I'm trying to leave that and live in this tension, live in this gray, you know, and realize that like life is more nuanced and complicated and anyone online can make anyone sound like anyone, you know? And like you said, I've had the best interactions when people will DM me, you know, you're a heretic, you're this. And I just send them an audio message. Actually, my name's Tim. This is my account. You know, more than willing to talk. And it's instant disarm. I mean, every time.
Yep.
And the people who want to talk will respond back. And we have a pretty, I would say, productive conversation, you know, and they end up understanding my perspective better, even if they don't agree with it. So I'm with you on all that. But I appreciate you making the time, you know, in an afternoon and from your busy schedule. Where can people find you? Are you online? Do you have some kind of public account that people can find you on?
Yeah, I mean, probably the primary place would be Twitter. I think I've renamed myself down here. If this shows up in the thing, I'm at MSG. So those are my initials.
Got like it.
Monosodium glutamate rights. So MSG rights, WRITES.
Well, I'll put a link in show notes, of course, to the article and into your Twitter. And yeah, listen, definitely keep in touch. You know, I think that for this to work, there has to be, like you said, despite me, I'm sure you and I can find plenty of things that we would disagree on theologically or socially, but it's all about, you know, what are the good faith conversations we can have and what can we agree on and say, yes, like, let's push this forward. You know, like Imago Dei, sign me up. Where do I sign? Let's go, you know?
Yeah.
So definitely keep in touch, and I appreciate you making the time.
All right. Thank you so much, Tim. I really appreciate you, and God bless everybody out there. I hope that Jesus meets you wherever you're at and whatever you've seen.
Well said. Thanks so much, Mike.